Hello, America, and welcome to the Wednesday Conversation. I'm Bethany Gilbert, and I'm here with Pastor Chris Hemmelman of First City Church in Bellevue, Nebraska, and Pastor Bob Thune and Pastor Dusty White of Coram Deo Church in Omaha, Nebraska. Every Wednesday, we sit down to talk about how the gospel of Jesus Christ connects to the questions and issues of everyday life. And today, we're talking about the canon of Western literature.
Bethany, I just want to thank you for saying me first. Mike always puts me last, but you put me first.
Yeah.
Thank you.
The last will be first.
Yeah. I think she should do the intro every week now.
You heard it.
Sorry,
here.
Mike.
You heard
Rest
it here.
Rest in peace, Mike. Recently, we talked about Ben Sasse's book, The Vanishing American Adult. And in chapter 8 of that book, he talks about essentially reading. He says, hey, one thing we need to do to be good citizens is just become readers and learners. And he brings up something in that chapter that I thought would be fruitful for us to talk about, which is the canon of Western literature. This is a subject that's come under fire in the past 20 or 30 years. The question being, is there such thing as a set of books or a sort of baseline literary works that everybody should sort of have to read in their education? There used to be sort of this common thought that, yeah, everybody needs to be familiar with certain great works of Western literature. However, I guess starting probably about 30 or 40 years ago, that idea increasingly came under fire, and Sasse chronicles that a little bit in his book, talks about those wars, mentions that in 1987, Jesse Jackson, when he was the Democratic presidential candidate, led a big demonstration at Stanford University, marching against the requirement that Stanford freshmen take a Western culture class. And that was primarily based on the fact that the books for that class were sort of seen, at least by Mr. Jackson, as a white man's canon, that these are sort of the privileged books of white Western European culture, and therefore they don't reflect a dynamic of global sort of culture. And so I thought it was an interesting question to bring up, mainly because I think I've faced this question in some of the conversations I've had about education, and especially as we think about what does it mean for the church to be sort of mindful of dynamics of race and power. This is one of those questions that I think is perpetually on the table. Is it wise and good to ask students in a society to be familiar with a certain number of works of literature? And certainly in American culture, does that list of literary works skew in a European direction?
Okay, so basically the argument from what I'm picking up is that instead of like following this canon of Western literature, we should just do away with it completely.
Yeah, that's Jesse Jackson's argument.
Okay.
Was let's do away with requiring college students to study Western civilization. Chris, since you are the only one in the room who's actually been an English teacher, what say you?
Well, there's a lot of things I could say. Just as a point of reference for Ben Sasse's book, one of the things that I appreciated about the way he handled this topic is talking about the necessity to have a national canon because it's something that unites us. Like he's pushing for, hey, if we're going to have a united country, if we're going to have a shared culture, shared values, then something like a literary canon needs to be constructed in such a way that it's pulling us together and uniting us around a set of ideas and ideals and a shared history. So I liked his approach because he sort of puts it on the table. It's like, look, we can debate what should be included in that canon, but let's debate that in the sense that we need to have one. We do, if we want to be united, that we need one. So he's appealing to a sense of unity here, even though he's taking on a topic that in many ways has created a sense of divisiveness and argumentation. So I appreciate about that, about his approach.
Do you want to hear a story?
Please, always.
Story time. When I lived in Austin, Texas, my neighbor down the street had a garage sale. And at his garage sale, he was selling a copy of the Great Books series, which was put out by the University of Chicago back in the 1950s. And it's a set of 52. It's like an encyclopedia set. Mm-hmm. They all match. Mm-hmm. It's a set of 52 books that Mortimer Adler was convinced were the sort of most classic and enduring works of Western literature. So that idea, I bought it for like $30. So I bought this like amazing 52-volume set of the great books for $30, and I thought it was the greatest buy ever. They're all sitting in my basement to this day. I've read at least a few of them.
Nice.
Not most
it
of them.
It looks good for
it. It looks really cool.
Walk down,
it looks so erudite and scholarly.
Yeah.
But here's the interesting thing about that is the reason that set got put together was because of this, because Mortimer Adler was a big proponent of the need for a national canon or a canon of books, a defined number of books that you could say, if you've read these 52 volumes, you understand how we got to where we are in Western culture. And so Encyclopedia Britannica started marketing that particular set called The Great Books for that purpose. And Sass actually mentions that particular set along with a couple others put out by Harvard back in the early 1900s and the middle of the 20th century, and sort of says, yeah, this is under debate now. So I guess in addition to my story, I would just say, ironically, it's three white guys and a white woman sitting around talking about whether the canon of Western literature is a white man's canon. And I'm going to defend the fact that whether it is or not, we need to have it. There's a reason for it. And that's maybe a controversial argument. We've faced this in the school that I helped to start. One of the questions we got is like, you know, are we going with like a Western civilization emphasis or more of a world civilization emphasis? Sort of as we think about literature and culture, what are the things that are going to be emphasized? So I feel like this is a live question, especially in a very global world.
Yeah. And as one who is taught largely within that Western tradition, I mean, my specialty was more American British literature. I had to teach a few world literature classes in my years, but I think one of the things that gets missed is that the Western canon is actually pretty multivocal. I think it's underappreciated how many voices are actually present. Now, yes, largely white European, but if you take just for instance the Harlem Renaissance in the United States. Just an incredible amount of literature and art and music came out of that time period, very much within the canon of Western literature and as far as the contributions to that were made. And so that's just one of many examples where a minority voice has found a strong spot within that canon. And so I think we need to not overstate that it's a white man's canon when there are plenty of spaces for minority voices.
Interesting. I wonder if we could ask the question too. It seems like in our day and age, everybody's worried about, are all the voices represented, right? Is there sort of like equality across the number of types of voices that are represented in a curriculum? Sass seems to make the case, hey, that's important, but it's not as important as a shared understanding of how we got here. Mm-hmm. And so I think my argument, if I were making an argument for a sort of great books approach to learning, that's what I would say. Even for a student who's an immigrant or a student who's minority or a student who's coming from sort of a different cultural heritage, I would say, well, if you're going to live in America, you still have to understand the dominant shaping influences in how America has come to be what it is. And so Sass points out, if you want to understand American jurisprudence, you have to understand the Romans, because all of our laws and our whole legal system is based on what we inherited from Rome. So it's important that you read old dead guys who are Roman white guys, not because they have better things to say, but because the tradition, we're standing on their shoulders in terms of how we do lawsuits and how we decide civil disputes and those kinds of things. And so to me, the question of are all voices equally represented does not seem to be as important as are we honoring and sharing together in how do we get to where we are, which includes things like slavery in America, which includes things like white patriarchy, right? These are topics that we need to understand, but I don't know how you understand them apart from sort of immersing yourself within the stream of history and culture that's gotten us there.
Yeah, and even some of those minority voices are still speaking within the tradition.
Yes.
And so there's a difference between a conversation within a tradition, hey, And in Sass's book, he brings up the example of Abraham Lincoln and how within Lincoln reading in the tradition and how that shaped him and the impact that had on our country and the growth and development, you think, so a voice like within the Harlem Renaissance, or a voice like Frederick Douglass, or others that are speaking within the tradition and wrestling out that tradition. How can we be hold our ideals more perfectly and more purely and grow and be better in that? That's much different than, I think, even what Jesse Jackson was doing in this whole scale rejection and segmenting off and breaking off and kind of deconstructing the tradition itself. Those are two different ways to speak, to have a minority voice speak to a tradition. Now, of course, the argument can be, well, the one side is, well, that's a, you know, the white man in power can kind of control those voices and kind of keep, you know, too much extreme views at bay. And so there's more control there. And again, I think, Bob, to your point, if you get so caught up in that, you miss the larger picture, which is we have a shared history, a shared experience that we need that. Otherwise, the alternative to that is the kind of fragmentation that we're starting to experience right now. And so the question becomes, okay, let's undo the canon. Let's undo this kind of shared experience, and let's just have extreme fragmentation. Is that what we want? Is that what we're going for? And that just seems to be cultural suicide in some regards. And so at some point you sort of have to like draw this line, like, hey, we got to be united around something, and that decision has to be made one way or another.
Interesting. I like your idea of working within a tradition, of knowing a tradition so that you can work within it, appropriate it, and even critique it.
Yeah, exactly. And that because what you're saying is that I want what we share to be continually what we share, and I want it just to be better.
Well, if I think about like the most famous speech in the civil rights movement, right? Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream.
Exactly.
He's saying, we'll
exactly.
rise up and live out the true meaning of our creed, which then he quotes from founding documents and says, this is what America was founded on by these old white guys with wigs. And if we're going to live that out truly, then we have to embrace the reality of civil rights. And so in a sense, he's operating within that tradition and appropriating the language of that tradition and showing us where were we missing
exactly.
Living out the ideal of that tradition.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that's where with bringing in minority voices and bringing in the shared experience of that becomes enriching to the canon, because it says, okay, here's the different ways that our tradition is experienced by different people to help us unify better and to live this out better and more united. And so that's why I've always enjoyed, even though admittedly, you know, when you're teaching, so to tell a story, when I taught in the East Coast, the high school I taught in was largely African American. And so to have a white teacher with a predominantly African American class teaching about the Harlem Renaissance, I kind of felt like, okay, I'm going to tell all these kids about the Black experience? No, I'm not going to. You know, I'll tell you about what, you know, who these authors were and help you guys analyze and think through this. But I always kind of felt a little weird trying to teach the minority voices as one who was more in the dominant culture. But at the same time, it really enriched my experience as an English teacher and helped me appreciate those voices more and really the diversity within the Western canon. So that it was a fun experience to be able to do that.
Chris, before we turn on the mics, it seemed like just a few paragraphs in here that SAS sparked something in you as a former English teacher. And you said something to the liking of, this is every teacher should read this to their class or something like that. Could you give an argument as to why?
So his point about a national canon, I think every literature teacher should read or should articulate those ideas to their class. One, because I heard this every single year I taught, beginning of the year, why do I need to read this? Why do I need to do this? One, here's why. Second, the posture that he's taking, again, which I think is so important, is a posture of unity. He's trying to draw people together. And in so many ways, literature and analyzing literature has been a place of just breaking down any sort of shared unity. It's a place of resentment and anger and criticism and looking for power plays. And so it just has become this very fragmented field of study. And so to say, hey, studying literature is actually to wrestle through what unites us and shapes us together, I think has a powerful voice, counter to the way that literature is taught today. So that's where it got me going.
SAS raises this question on page 222. Who decides which books are in and out? Isn't classic just another way of saying what the powerful want you to read to reinforce the biases that led to their hegemony? Isn't judgment itself discriminatory? To advocates for multiculturalism, any attempt to create a definitive list of what to read was attacked as provincial, ethnocentric, or guilty of reinforcing privilege. Sass observes that by the late 1980s, those voices had sort of won out, and you started to see universities especially move away from sort of a strong liberal arts curriculum and away from saying everyone should sort of have a knowledge of these basic works of literature. So I even think back to my own, you know, in high school when I was growing up, which was, you know, it was a long time ago. Granted.
You're so old. You're so old.
I mean, you had to read Shakespeare. Like, there was, you could not graduate from high school and not read Shakespeare. Now, pretty sure you can. Like, I, you know, everybody still honors Shakespeare, but I'm pretty sure the sort of like, you absolutely cannot consider yourself to have a high school diploma and not have been immersed in or, you know, subjected to the writing of William Shakespeare. I think that's less and less true because that sort of cultural critique of, well, aren't we just privileging dead old white guys, has gained some traction. But I am convinced if you look at the question of what does it require to be educated, that you can't, in the culture that we are in, you can't intelligently debate unless you share the understanding of formative influences in that culture, right? I mean, that's what I'm looking across the table at you going, right, Chris?
Yeah.
Not a smile. But it seems to me that that's what we're saying here is, for the sake of intelligent and educated disagreement, it does matter that we have some shared tradition to start from, because that's what allows a common foundation of disagreement. And it seems like the more we've moved away from sort of a canon of literature or a, you know, a Western culture sort of basis, the more fragmented, isolated, and sort of like not able to listen to each other and intelligently debate we seem to become.
Yeah, if we can't sit in a classroom and analyze Shakespeare and disagree with him where we want to disagree with him and affirm what we want to affirm and do that in a way that is constructive and helpful, then how are we ever going to do that in our conversations about politics and policy and all those things? And so in many ways it becomes, this is the laboratory, so to speak, where the ideas that have shaped our civilization are wrestled through and shaped and sharpened and hopefully grow. And so it in many ways it's preparing us. And this is what I would tell my students, like, okay, I don't care. Okay. You forget Shakespeare after you leave this class and you don't remember a single word of Hamlet or Macbeth. Fine. Well, that's a little sad, but my hope would be that you had to wrestle with ideas here that are going to shape you and you can carry into your life as a human being contributing to society later on in life. And so this becomes very important because if my approach to Shakespeare is just, he's a dead white guy who was just part of, you know, the power structure, and it's just resentment and anger and criticism, which if you actually read Shakespeare, none of that holds up because the guy, you can't pin Shakespeare to a political agenda. It's just too hard. But the point is if that's all I'm going to engage, if that's the way I'm going to engage literature, that's the way I'm going to engage the rest of society and culture, and we're just creating more and more the inability to ground ourselves in any sort of like sustained thought. And I would even say hopeful thought. How do we argue in such a way that is, hey, we're trying to come together and not just, you know, blow everything up.
And that's exactly the argument that Sass is making in this book, right? He's saying for a republic survival, they're going to have a common language, and it's going to have to be a literate one. And so even if you don't like Shakespeare, I'm thinking about our household right now, and there's certain kids in my house that like certain authors and some that they can't stand. And I'm kind of like, well, you still have to read it because it's just, it's a common language that we're going to have here. And he says in the book, it's not only the content of a book that changes you, but the shared community with those who have read it, discussed it, argued about it. Books create communities here and now, as well as across space and time. And so he's saying, you have to read this so that when we talk about this, we have a common reference point. So I could not like Shakespeare, but I have to have an understanding of it in order to interact in culture.
He says also, teaching history does not mean accepting our history uncritically, nor does it mean simply going along to get along. Rather, living in a constitutional republic means that we fight, we argue, and we debate. But we will fail to have meaningful debates if we are not building on a shared history, which is kind of your, back to your point about the great tradition that we stand in.
And I know I've already made this point, but I just want to reemphasize it. I have always struggled with people that make this argument about, you know, white man canon, you know, power, reinforcing power, blah, 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 blah. Because I want to ask, have you actually sat down and read some of these works? Because they're much more complicated and nuanced and challenging than that. Yes, is some of that embedded into some of the literature? Absolutely. But it's not that uniform. It's not that just whitewashed, so to speak. It is much, much more complicated and complex than that. And so to make that criticism, I think, is a bit uninformed. And I honestly don't think that I'm underselling this. Like, I will debate this all day long. It is a much more complex history with many more voices and angles. Not everybody was a racist that was pro-slavery writing. Not everybody was just the white man is awesome and anybody of color is horrible. That's not how it is. So I just want to make that point clear that our canon is complex and multivocal, and that should be appreciated more than I think sometimes it is.
It's perhaps also worth noting that enduring works are enduring for a reason. Why do we still read Shakespeare? There was probably many authors working in Shakespeare's day whose works have been lost to us, but there's a reason why his have remained. Likewise with, you know, pick anyone, Cicero or Homer, any famous ancient author. And so for that reason, because of the enduring nature of those works, there's a timelessness to them, and I think it's because they tend to get at very core, deep human questions. Now, they're always coming at those from some cultural perspective because that's impossible to avoid. But it's oftentimes their processing of those questions. For instance, how do you, you know, in a Shakespeare work like Macbeth, how do you deal with guilt, right? Mm-hmm. It's a core human question that all of us are wrestling with at various levels. And so for those reasons, those most enduring works of literature tend to be the ones that make us think the most deeply about our own reality and experience.
And hasn't this been, with using the example of Shakespeare, he's so adaptable. I mean, you can go watch a Shakespeare play put on in any culture and it work.
Yeah.
I think it was Shakespeare in the Park here in Omaha 2 summers ago. They did Macbeth with that stylistically kind of had this Japanese samurai shogun thing going on, and it worked because the themes are so universal. It's not just locked into, you know, the Scottish, you know, highlands of, you know, whatever 1400s that it probably took place, or even maybe earlier than that. But
so interesting application. Just, I mean, obviously we're just sort of talking about literature here, but I think it's interesting to apply this even to Christian community. And just, this is why the scriptures are so foundational to our shared life and why we need to be good students of the Bible, because we're using the word canon in the cultural sense here, but obviously we believe there's also a canon of scripture, an enduring set of books handed down to us that in a sense shape our dialogue and form the tradition from which we're able to understand who God is and critique what needs to be critiqued in the world. So it's interesting to think about how much the printed word, the written word, shapes not only our shared culture as Americans or as Westerners, but also our shared culture as Christians. I do think for those of us who are raising kids, it's important for us to think about the shaping of our kids in terms of there are things they need to be exposed to. And even if the school they go to says, yeah, they don't need to read Shakespeare, they don't need to know about this or that, it's probably still important to try to expose them to as much of that as we can, just because I do think there's what it means to be educated, to be literate, right? There's a reason that literate and literature are from the same root. What it means to be literate is to be read, to be conversant in very important culturally shaping things. And because we live in the West, these are the things that have shaped our culture. Now, if we lived in India or if we lived in Indonesia or someplace like that, of course, the canon, the shaping influences of that culture would be different. But we live in America, and so it is important that we're conversant in the most dominant shaping works of literature that have sort of had a great influence on the West. And when we say the West, we're going all the way back to, you know, Rome and beyond. So I think for whether we're asking the question for ourselves or for, you know, our kids, the question is, yep, we need to value, we should value being literate to the best degree that we can so that we can have the right kind of cultural influence, so that we're able to dialogue meaningfully about the things that have shaped our culture and that provide a jumping off point for us to meaningfully engage.
Well, if any of you have thoughts on this topic, we would love to hear those thoughts. So you can email us at podcast@cdomaha.com. And that's going to do it for this week's conversation. The goal of this podcast is to equip our own church for discipleship and mission. So if you're a Christian or a church leader in another context, we invite you to listen in, and we pray that the things we're talking about might also be helpful to you as you minister in your own context. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you again next week on the Wednesday Conversation.